This is the People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and for the third time, the Netherlands have qualified for the finals in the World Cup tournament, defeating Uruguay 3-2 in a very exciting semifinal. We'll hear from Lazar Trishan, a Uruguayan blogger with the blog NoMoreOnionBags.com, and then we'll hear from our own producer, Fernando Romero, who all along has been a stealth partisan for the Orange. And in our featured interview today, we speak with author David Goldblatt. His book, The Ball is Round, A Global History of Soccer, is the most eloquent, epic history of the global game I have ever encountered. Just like we try to do on The People's Game, David Goldblatt, in his long history of soccer, not only recounts some of the great events that take place on the field, but also puts the sport into its political, cultural, economic context. David Goldblatt was also in South Africa blogging for Prospect magazine, so we'll ask him to reflect on his experiences in South Africa and to put the 2010 World Cup into the broader context of the long history of soccer. And at the end of the show, we'll hear from our co-host Jennifer Doyle, who was astounded to hear truly disturbing facts about how extreme the underreporting of women's sports truly is. So stay tuned for The People's Game. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined right now by Lazar Trishan, he of the blog No More Onion Bags, and he of the correspondent role on The People's Game for the country of Uruguay in the 2010 World Cup. That, Lazar, I felt was a heroic effort, once again, from the Uruguayan team.
Well, we leave with our heads held high. I mean, we lost to a better team, I think, and, you know, we probably can have a couple complaints here or there about some of the calls. I think they're probably a better team, and I think everybody's proud of the team.
The call that stands out is the question as to whether Van Persie was offside on the second goal. When I watched it live, I thought for sure it was offside and it would be called back. What was your take on that?
I mean, it seemed, you know, everybody was looking right to the linesman, even the Dutch player, so it seemed like even if he doesn't touch it, you know, the goalkeeper, you know, is either blocked by him or faked out by the fact that he looks like he's going to kick it and doesn't. You know, there are a lot of calls in soccer about that are just huge gray areas. I think that's one of them. They definitely called it against Paraguay in the Paraguay game, the same play. I'm not completely sure the Robin block in the box in the last minute wasn't a handball either. We didn't see replays of it, and I think that might have been FIFA deciding not to replay there. Regardless, you know, we went out heads held high and played a good game, I thought.
Well, and then the other thing that was a little odd at the end of the match was Forlan being pulled. When Forlan scored the equalizer, let alone almost putting them ahead with a free kick in the about 65th, 66th minute, Forlan, I thought, was establishing himself as the clear front runner as player of the tournament. So to see him get pulled in the 83rd minute, two goals down, was a little odd. Your thoughts on that?
Well, he actually did have a little injury. He got hurt at the very beginning of the game, so they didn't want to take any chances once it looked like the game was out of reach. But, you know, I just thought he wasn't running as much. He had a couple great free kicks, obviously. He had the incredible left-footed shot, I mean, showing that he's the greatest ambidextrous or ambi-footed, I think, forward, certainly in the game today. You know, if not ever, can just bash him from distance with both feet. And it was nice to give him a little ovation.
Yeah, and then his mastery of the ball, when so many other people in this tournament have been dumbfounded as to how to control the ball, has just really been impressive off the free kicks especially, but really in everything he does.
Yeah, and I think we saw that when they pulled back into that, you know, Enganche, you know, number 10 role, that he could do that too and not just be a forward. I mean, it's great credit to him. He's a great guy. You know, he's a UNICEF ambassador. He has a foundation. Not one of these foundations. It's like a tax haven. He really does stuff, and it's great, you know, to see him have so much success on a big stage.
What did it mean to you the final 5 minutes? I mean, they sure didn't give up till the end. They nicked that goal back, and then the last minute and a half, you have to wonder what the heck was going on with the Dutch side. I mean, here's a team that, you know, can be pretty good at ball control and playing keep away. You'd figure they'd be able to do that. Most professional soccer sides can to some extent, and they seemed almost incapable Do you think that they had just sort of breathed out and Uruguay almost was able to come back in and pull something just which would have been unbelievable off?
Well, it's amazing. Once you have nothing to play, you know, you're playing with nothing to lose, you play a lot looser, and the Dutch clearly got really tight. You know, soccer is it's just a crazy game of momentum, and I think we saw that Uruguay was strong early, then the Dutch really came on, then they scored their first goal, and then Uruguay came back and scored and really had momentum at the beginning. The first actual 10, 15 minutes of the second half, I thought were all Uruguay, and then it was all Holland again. It's crazy how momentum and confidence, you know, interact.
So for those 10 or 15 minutes there, were you thinking, oh, my God, this is going to happen, we're going to make it through to the finals?
You know, when Forlan took that free kick that they just saved out of bounds, you know, I felt pretty good. But you have to also hand it to the Dutch. You know, we played a little bit not to lose. We kind of had three defensive midfielders. They took off one of their two defensive midfielders and put on Van der Vaart. You know, they went for the game.
Well, they went for the game, but the guy got smacked in the, you know, who knows how his neck and head are feeling after he, you know, his adrenaline stops flowing at the halftime break, you know. That guy took quite a shot there.
True, but they put on Rafael van der Vaart, who couldn't defend me. I mean, they could have put on somebody slightly more defensive there. You know, they put on a real offensive player, and it's good to see teams being rewarded for going for the game, you know, even if they are filled with guys who aren't, like, the most likable in the world, like your Arjen Robbins and Robin van Persie, but whatever.
So later on in this show, we're going to have a feature-length interview with David Goldblatt, who wrote the book The Ball is Around, a Global History of Soccer. And, you know, to most soccer fans who know their history, Uruguay has, you know, always comes up. Obviously, the two World Cup titles, one of the nations where the sort of formal organization of football was developed. But it's been reduced to being the sort of like historical oddity. This tiny country, you know, across the river from Argentina was fantastic decades ago, but certainly they can't compete, you know, in the contemporary era where all the big nations dominate. This must have meant something else to Uruguayans. It must really have meant something.
Yeah, I mean, it's been incredible in Uruguay. You know, there were tons of people on 18 de Julio, the main street, and leading up to the Blessing Independencia. I mean, everybody was into it. You know, Uruguay also had an election last year, which was very divisive, and the country was, I wouldn't say torn apart, but very divided, you know, even on soccer terms. Typically, Uruguayan soccer, since we don't do well in the big tournaments, is restricted to Peñarol Nacional, the huge club divide, and that's just a huge division. So it's been great for the country to be able to get completely together around something and have people know us for something great. You know, three wins in a row in the World Cup, we did at one point, was really terrific.
You know, in terms of people around the world thinking Uruguay, it's been bigger than 1930 and 1950 combined because the nature of the tournament is that much bigger. So it really was quite an amazing run. I thought they played beautifully organized football throughout. They knew their limitations as a side and that they had this exceptional player in the middle. And I suppose one thing that will be sort of left in the back of the mind is what they could have done maybe had they had Suarez. Because I do think the complete side with all the players out, with their organizational, with their, you know, tactical acumen, it's one of the sides of the tournament, no doubt.
I think so, too, and I think we got rid of, you know, the reputation we had from that game against Scotland in the 70s. One game made an entire reputation of being, you know, a bit thuggish, and I think we got over that. I mean, we certainly weren't tough guys any more than any other team.
Let me ask you one final question. You've been a great correspondent, as it were, for us on the show, The People's Game. You've been saying throughout that, you know, Uruguay were playing with house money. They got deeper in the tournament than you probably expected. But it still must hurt a little bit, no?
You know, when it was 1-1 at the half, I was kind of like, you know, when we scored, I was kind of like, this is good enough for me. You know, we came back and showed. And I have to admit, the first 10, 15 minutes spoiled me, thinking that we really could beat them. So it was tougher than I expected. But, you know, you can't be let down unless you get your hopes up. And it was, you know, a great ride.
They certainly showed themselves so proud in the last 5 minutes with the extra goal, even after Forlan. And I suppose even one final question, since you now have watched this Dutch side and thought about them so intensely for the past few days, seen them perform against your side, everybody does know a lot about the Spanish team going into this tournament and the German team. Do you think this Dutch team could take either of those right now? I'm thinking they maybe don't have enough to do that.
Not at all. I mean, I think they have the, as good of individual players as anyone, but I think, as Uruguay said, you need to have chemistry. And, like, you could even see it. You know, even on the second goal, Snyder takes the ball off the foot of somebody. I think it's Kaut or Van der Vaart. You know, too many of those guys just don't like each other. And I really don't think when you get to once they have to play a team that's even better, like a Germany or a Spain, and those teams seem really united right now, who has most of their good players and is playing really well, that a team without chemistry can beat them.
Lazar Shahan, it's been a pleasure having you on during the People's Game, and everybody should check out the great blog, nomoreonionbags.com.
Thanks so much. See you in 4 years.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined by the producer of The People's Game, Fernando Romero. Fernando's been on the show before, mostly talking about USA and Mexico, but folks, he is a stealth Orange fan. He's the one who introduced me to David Winter's great book, Brilliant Orange, The Neurotic Genius of Dutch Football. Fernando Romero, was Van Persie offside on goal number two?
Yes, he was. They should have called that offside. You know what? Any other time, I would have been beside myself if it had been my team. But you know what? I think if you want to get into the topic of, you know, cheating and not cheating, I mean, I think the Uruguayans are ones to start with. But I feel pretty good about today's game.
So you thought the performance was high level Dutch football?
I think today they did come out swinging. They didn't play to their peak performance that we all imagined them to play at. But nonetheless, they control the ball. They had possession of the ball throughout the whole game. And, you know, Snyder's on fire. Robin's on fire. Van Persie's been a little bit underneath his performance that we all know he can play at. But, you know, I think even Dirk Kuyt was amazing today. Today he was, I would give him player of the game for today as well.
Well, Kuyt seems to be the one guy who really can fit always into the scheme of a total football type scheme because he can go all over the field. But it does seem to me, Van Persie, Robin up front, Snyder attacking midfielder, defensive back midfielders, at least before Van der Vaart comes in, and then defenders. This is not total football. This is a classical position to play soccer, isn't it?
Exactly. I think you have Van Persie at the front line, and then you have three or four midfielders, including Robin, Snyder, Kuyt, and even the outro Mark Van Bommel into that mix. It's not total football. You have just one guy at the top, and the other are just very positioned players. And it's not, I'm not surprised that Van Persie isn't doing very well because he's just playing by himself up top. But they're getting results done, and I don't think any Dutch fan or any Dutch citizen would mind that they're not playing either total football or even beautiful football. They're in the finals, and that's what I think the people in Holland are going berserk right now.
Right, and Giovanni van Bronckhorst, while he isn't attacking up the winds and shifting positions and such as total football would call for, he proved that maybe, you know, clearly he is the product of the total football Dutch system, because boy, he showed what he could do. That has to be the strike of the tournament so far, goal number one for Holland.
Right. I got to give it up to Gio. I had been very critical of him, and people that I've watched the games with, or people that know me, that I've talked to about the Dutch national team. I've been really critical of Gio van Bronckhorst for the last couple of games, even leading up to the tournament. But today he proved himself to be, you know, not only the captain of the team, but very resilient and very resourceful going up top and scoring a goal for us today.
So it's been 32 years. Now they're going to be back in the final. It could be a rematch of the game that haunts the imagination of Dutch fans, the 74 final of Germany versus Holland, then West Germany versus, of course, Holland. Could be Spain. Do you think this team has enough to take either of those sides?
You know what? I'm going to say yes. I would put my money where my mouth is. I would say Holland would take. I am craving for Holland-Germany final. I know the Dutch will pull it off. I'm going to call the score right now 3-2 Holland on Sunday.
Fernando Romero, producer of The People's Game, thank you much for joining us here
thank
on the
you.
Show.
Thank you.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined on the phone by David Goldblatt. David Goldblatt has written perhaps the exceptional history of global soccer. It is called The Ball is Round, A Global History of Soccer. That, of course, is the American title. It weighs in at 990 pages, and it truly is an amazing work that documents the beginnings of the sport, in fact, going back before the sport is formally soccer, its evolution into soccer, and then the way that it spread around the world, looking at all the different areas of the world and how soccer has emerged there in all of its nuance, with a lot of political, social, and cultural background absolutely integrated into the way that the history of soccer is developed in this fantastic book, The Ball is Round. We'll talk to David Goldblatt in a second about the book and maybe how he sees the 2010 World Cup fitting into the long history of soccer. But first, I want to talk to David Goldblatt about the blogs he was posting from South Africa for Prospect Magazine, which you can find at prospectmagazine.co.uk. And what I want to ask David Goldblatt about initially is that from reading his blogs in particular and a few others that I've read, it seems that there really are two World Cups. One that the vast majority of people around the world experience via their television sets, or perhaps now their internet connections, and the people who are at the games themselves. David Goldblatt now has returned from South Africa to England, so maybe he can do a comparison. How different is it to be at the games and then to experience it on the television? And what does that say about where global football is today? David Goldblatt, welcome to the People's Game.
Yeah, nice. Thank you very much. Quite an introduction. Much appreciated. I mean, I think the first thing one notices when comparing, you know, the World Cup on the sofa from the World Cup being there is the vuvuzela. I mean, certainly in Britain, there's been a great deal of complaint about the vuvuzelas. People want vuvuzela-free coverage. You've had broadcasters having the temerity to ask the organising committee whether they can stop people blowing them. Of course, this has all ended and the vuvuzela is here to stay. But certainly on the television, it does sound like a kind of buzzing group of insects, pretty high-pitched, pretty relentless, not much kind of change in tone or feel. But actually in the stadiums, it's completely different, particularly when you've got a lot of South Africans there who know what they're doing. You know, you get enormous range of volume up and down. You don't just get the high notes. You get all the kind of deep notes. And, in some ways, I think in South Africa, the vuvuzela is love because it's like blowing a raspberry and sticking it to the man. And that's kind of, that's what's in part is going on. It's a great big collective sticking it to the man. You also get, you know, call and response amongst the vuvuzelas in the stadium. So, you know, you'll have one person who's got a little bit more breath, say, than the others, who can toot out a rhythm or a tune, and then people coming in on the final note or the final beat of that. You know, when corners and free kicks happen, again, you get a kind of great swelling of noise at many different levels that really kind of enhances the moment. And I must say, amongst the Ghanaians in particular, who I was lucky enough to sit by, you get some real musical action where the vuvuzelas and the drums are coming together. Now, I'm not saying it's right for every football culture, but certainly in South Africa, often it worked fantastically. So that's part of the immediacy, I think, and difference. I think another thing is that in a funny way, it feels like a much more sort of managed and commercial operation on the television. All the kind of kinks are sort of smoothed out. All the rough edges have been dealt with. And, you know, the kind of the advertising and the logos and the branding are all somehow much more up front. Whereas I was finding in South Africa there was so much else to look at and so much else to think about that in a way I didn't see Sony and those guys. They just sort of disappeared off into the background, which is another great thing about the vuvuzela, let me tell you, is that it means you can't hear those Coke adverts in the stadium, which is a blessing in itself.
You know, the spectacle here on television is, it is after a while, you're 2 weeks into the tournament, and it all sort of blurs together, at least with ESPN's coverage and also with Univision. You know what to expect every single day. I imagine the dimension of the experience when you're in South Africa, and in particular the 2010 World Cup in South Africa as opposed to maybe in 2006 in Germany, was just rife with dimension.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, just getting, you know, every day in South Africa is a sort of practical and moral challenge, you know, in terms of how you're operating and where you're going and what you're doing. So a great deal of, you know, energy is absorbed in a most engaging way just getting about. I mean, South Africa's a pretty big place compared to, say, Germany 2006. And I mean, I was lucky enough to do some pretty epic journeys as part of it. I went to see the England-Germany game in Bloemfontein, and I drove a round trip of around 2,300 kilometers from Cape Town, which was extraordinary. I mean, obviously, what lay at the end in Bloemfontein was not quite as I imagined it, but to drive the Karoo Desert to see, you know, night desert skies with more stars than I've ever seen, and with the prospect of a round of 16 World Cup at the end of your journey is extraordinary. So at that level, just the kind of the landscapes, the spaces, you know, South Africa is an extraordinary eye-popping country. And then, of course, you know, wherever you look in South Africa, I mean, it makes me laugh that you know, there is talk of countries and cities cleaning themselves up before the world comes and, you know, sweeping stuff under the carpet. I mean, in South Africa, you can't sweep the nature of the society under the carpet. It's there, you know, bare right in front of you, you know, on the run-in from Cape Town Airport, you know, towards Greenpoint Stadium, taking a taxi to get myself there on time. You know, you go past, as South Africans, particularly white South Africans, would say, world-class shopping malls and the most unbelievable sort of seafront properties. And then, you know, shanty towns bang next to them, but for a wall and barbed wire pressed up against the motorway. Those sort of contrasts are everywhere in South Africa. I mean, the strongest sort of moment for me, tugging at all of those sorts of emotions and differences, was going to Soccer City in Soweto to see Brazil versus Cote d'Ivoire. And I went there at night, and the stadium is absolutely stunning. I mean, it is designed to be breathtaking. And I don't know how much the television can capture the scale of it, because Soweto, because actually there remains pitifully little street lighting in what is, you know, a city of 2 to 3 million people. Soccer City sits against a kind of, you know, blank, a canvas of almost complete darkness, and you know, is illuminated brilliantly from below, and you approach it over a kind of gigantic bridge, which gives you a sort of sense of almost being in the air. It's a little bit, I don't know, kind of sci-fi almost, the way you approach the sort of spaceship floating in the air. And of course, the bridge, again, is swathed in darkness, and below it are some pretty gritty and some pretty run-down railway tracks, which, you know, in the day would make the scene look very different. And it is, you know, there's quite a cynic in me often, but it was swept away by the kind of majesty of this building. And inside the shell, the calabash shell, the hallways make one feel, you know, like a character in, you know, Jack and the Beanstalk in the giant's kind of castle. The scale of it is really awesome. And part of me thinks, you know, that is amazing that that is in Soweto, that something of this scale and grandeur is placed in Soweto and, you know, makes, you know, contributes to making it what it is. And then on the other hand, you see, you know, I also went to Soweto in the daytime to the fan parks and to a Shebeen to watch a game and so on. And, you know, although Soweto's changed massively in the 15 years since I first saw it, you know, the scale of the inequalities and of the sheer urban needs of modern South Africa whack you right in the face. And there we are, you know. I mean, and I don't know what the answer to the question is, you know. Is it the right way to spend a billion bucks? You know, they sure got a bang for it. And South Africa's all about that. It's about almost about sort of unanswerable questions and impossible divisions to straddle that somehow people are grappling and groping towards. And I felt that sort of energy and those issues around every element of the World Cup, and it made it a kind of, you know, an amazing experience to be there.
David Goldblatt has been blogging on the World Cup for Prospect Magazine, and you can find the blogs at prospectmagazine.co.uk. He is also the author of the epic history of soccer entitled The Ball is Round, A Global History of Soccer. That was originally published in advance of the 2006 World Cup in Germany. The final chapter, the final part of this epic 990-page book, is called The Only Game, Football and the End of History, 1990 to 2006. And then it has a short conclusion entitled The Game at the End of the World. The book, The Ball is Round, does an exceptional job of tracking the evolution of soccer in the political, social, economic, and cultural context of the regions that are being analyzed in each section of the book. Well, since 2006, there have been some significant changes in sort of global geopolitics and economics, in particular, the global financial meltdown of 2007-2008. And it's in the wake of this that this most spectacular of World Cups in South Africa is taking place, though that particular social-economic fact seems overwhelmed by the mere fact of this spectacle taking place in Africa itself. So I want to first go back to part five of your book and the conclusion, Football in the End of History, the game at the end of the world. Following the end of the Cold War, it does seem that global football really further established itself as the global game, the only global game of real significance. Why do you think that that took place in the wake of the Cold War?
Well, I think the wake of the Cold War is also the moment that, you know, the economies of and the technologies of globalization are transformed. You know, as the Berlin Wall is falling, you know, satellites for pay-per-view television are heading into space at a rate of knots. And I think the arrival of satellite television, the arrival of the internet, is absolutely central to the growing popularity of the game. I think it's also the moment, for reasons in part connected to the end of the war, but with their own dynamic, where the commercialization of football in Europe, first and foremost, really begins to take off. And what is created as part of that is an extraordinary televisual spectacular, which is then available all over the world. So I think at that level, that globalization of the highest levels of professional football, which is around which at least some of the kind of global mania for football is created, happens then. I mean, I think the other, you know, the last 20 years have seen, you know, enormous spread, of course, of television and through mobile phones and access to information. So, you know, parts of the world that were just not on the map as far as, you know, engaging with global football or the World Cup, those things have opened up. I'm not sure that football is kind of spread any further just in terms of people playing it or being introduced to it. Football, in a sense, is already, as a participative thing, had already spread. What's changed is how those participative cultures, you know, have been energized or shaped or changed by access to the kind of global professional game.
Let's talk a little bit about the game at the end of the world. What are your primary points that you draw in your conclusion from your book as you wrote it in 2006?
Well, the first thing in the conclusion to the book is just to say why. Why is football at this moment, you know, not merely the global game, but one of, you know, really very few truly popular global cultural phenomena? In an era of globalization in many, many different dimensions, you know, what is there to top it? So that was the question I wanted to ask myself and draw together the threads of the earlier parts of the book. And I concluded, I suppose, you know, there were three elements to the answer that make up that conclusion. One is to say it's something about the game itself. It's something about the political and economic conditions under which it was generated and diffused around the world. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, it's something about the way in which football, I think, in quite a sort of deep and subtle way, speaks to a whole lot of global dilemmas and issues that engage us. So in terms of the game itself, you know, it's about simplicity, it's about flexibility, it's about the fact, you know, you can play it with two, you can play it with three, you can play it with 50. You don't even need to know the rules that well to get a game that basically works. I mean, it's endlessly variable. It can be played on such a variety of surfaces. I think in terms of the dynamics of the game, I think the question of flow is absolutely central. It's that, for me, the sort of unbrokenness of it. And that's not to say that there aren't, of course, you know, great pleasures and narrative structures that emerge from very sequential games like cricket and baseball, which have their own sort of, you know, narrative beauties. But if you, what you want is the sort of rip-roaring, page-turning thriller then football's kind of inner structure of play seems to deliver that. And, you know, with so few goals, there is a kind of orgasmic punctuation about scoring in football and reflected in its crowds that I don't find in any other sport. You know, I mean, much as I like basketball, it's just, you know, 199-117. It's just not quite the same as 1-0.
But it's Eros and Thanatos, because for one side it's Eros, the other side is Thanatos. I mean, the American audience is just finally catching on that the violation that comes with being scored upon is unto death.
And that's, you know, that's and it's sort of, it's often unjust and irrational. And I kind of like, I like that if you're in the business of storytelling rather than right. sort of rational theories of justice, football delivers on that. And then, of course, you know, it matters that it's from England and from Britain at the point at which Britain is the global hegemon,
sure.
at which, you know, Britain's connections with the rest of the world are more extensive than anybody else's, and in which, you know, there's a lot of Anglophilia in the world. You know, I mean, we forget, I think, in Britain that, you know, once upon a time, you know, to be British or to be an Anglophile was to be sophisticated, to be modern, to be liberal, to be advanced. And, you know, football becomes the kind of bearer of that. I mean, of course, it then takes on a thousand other meanings in a thousand other places. And I think that, again, is something interesting with football. I've often wondered whether, you know, the failure of baseball and American football to spread as widely as football is at least in part to do with, you know, their Americanness is buried so deep in the language and the structures of the game that it has been harder for others to make them their own, whereas football has come as a slightly blanker slate. And then
it could also be a reflection of the fact of British colonialism was a straight-on rule, whereas American rule was done by proxy in general.
I think that's true. Though, of course, the strange thing with the British Empire is that, you know, in many of places, I mean, where there is direct, you know, direct rule and a sort of major British population, ethnically, you know, they don't play football as their first game initially. So
right.
the Australians are off playing Aussie rules football, mm-hmm. both codes of rugby, and frankly, anything other than football. In India, you know, the Indian elites opt for cricket as both, you know, an expression of their relationship to England and as a challenge to it, but not to football. The Afrikaners and, you know, English-speaking whites in South Africa choose rugby too. So, and of course, then there's the whole Irish dimension. So I think that's part of the story. And then there was a third thing that I wanted to say about football, which was, I suppose, it has at its heart, it embraces uncertainty. It embraces implausibility in a way that I think, you know, no other game for me quite touches. I mean, I love it that in football it is still possible for, just on occasion, the manifestly weaker team, sometimes the team that plays worst, to win a game, to turn the tables for whatever, you know, extraordinary reason. And that's the sort of world we live in. I think we live in a world of uncertainty and in which reactivity and spontaneity, you know, are what's required. My God, the world is changes before our eyes at a rate that has never happened before in human history. So football for me sort of speaks to that world in a way that nothing else quite manages. And, you know, the World Cup this time around, for me anyway, has been delivering on uncertainty and reactivity and injustice, if not always the most graceful football I've ever seen.
And I think it can play both ways, sometimes both as injustice and sometimes as wish fulfillment, because sometimes, you know, oftentimes the general flow of social, cultural, economic, political history is overwhelmingly imbalanced towards the overdog. And it gives a wish that the underdog can somehow snap back and get that goal against the run of play. So
yeah.
I see that. That's a very beautiful point. I do want to point out to people, because, of course, we only have a limited amount of time, that the details of the histories that are told in this book are just unbelievable. So next time you're reflecting on Argentinian soccer, Diego Maradona, Leo Messi, pick up this book and read the section on the development of the sport in Argentina or any other theater as it world in terms of global football, interested in East Asia, interested in how it developed on the peripheries of the sport and right at the core of the sport. It's so much of it is covered here. It's covered elegantly. And by the way, the individual games that you focus on are recounted with great drama and capturing really the feel of matches. And I can testify to that because later on in the book, of course, I'm familiar with a few of the matches that you recount. Now, I suppose the big question for someone who's written such a book is to try, and I know this is always a difficult question for a historian, to try then to contextualize the 2010 World Cup in the long history of soccer. And I suppose there's sort of three framings that I'll ask about. One is, of course, the fact that it has taken place in Africa, in South Africa, as it relates to the role of Africa in global football. Two, even more general, the where this fits in then into the world in 2010. And then third, more basic, how the games have played out in the field. And in particular, right now, I'm interested in your reflections on the German side and the fact that they've produced this exciting young team out of a Bundesliga that's not as top-loaded with global stars on the top teams like Serie A, La Liga, and the Premiership. So first to the tournament in Africa in the context of the history of the sport.
The tournament in Africa, what I would say is I think this is part of something, a sort of bigger drift, is that, you know, the global sporting mega events of the world are going to the global south. You know, it's 2010 South Africa, it's 2014 Brazil, and I, you know, if the rumors that I hear around the FIFA HQ in South Africa are right, 2018 could well be going to Russia. Meantime, they're doing the Winter Olympics in 2014, there's the Rio Olympics, and even India is getting in on the act with the Commonwealth Games later this year. So, I mean, there's indices of, you know, it's not a perfect measure or index of the shifts of power in the new global economy. But it's not a bad one. And I think we should see, in a way, South Africa 2010 as part, and, you know, of course, Beijing 2008 Olympics. Mm-hmm. So I would see it in part as part of that bigger shift of power to the global south that we are seeing. In terms of Africa, I think the thing that's been missing from this World Cup, but I think one has to grasp to understand why it's so important in Africa, beyond merely that, you know, one is having an event and one is taking one's place at the sort of global table, is the depth in popular culture and folk memory of the political and social significance of football. Football, you know, was intimately linked to the liberation struggles in Africa from the beginning of the 20th century right through to independence and post-independence politics. Many African nationalists got their early administrative training in football clubs as an institution that, you know, they were able to run when other avenues were blocked off. And, of course, you know, taking the colonist game and then turning it against them, I mean, that is an extraordinary, you know, it's a display of resistance. It is a way of shaking off the psychological and emotional shackles and injustices of racism and colonialism. I mean, and football is the place that African men and, you know, now in a new generation, African women are taking that stuff. So I think, and that's been missing from this World Cup. I don't think South Africa, I don't think FIFA have really let us in on that one in the way that they have cast the tournament. But that is why it is, you know, people give such a damn, or one of the many reasons people give such a damn about it. I mean, I think in the end it's been, you know, thank the Lord for Ghana, because it was in danger of not being much of an African World Cup. Right. I mean, all the plans to make it African in terms of other Southern African countries hosting, you know, training games or teams in the run-up to the tournament, in terms of the number of Africans who can actually afford to show up or buy a ticket, in terms of almost the African feel of some of South Africa's cities, where, you know, FIFA's kind of super-duper exclusion policy has meant that, you know, local signage and traders have been cleared many, many kilometers away from where the action is, was in danger of, you know, actually making it pretty un-African. And I think Ghana and the way that South Africans of all stripes have got behind Ghana as their team in this tournament has been, you know, has been the saving grace of that and kept it as a kind of, you know, at some level properly as an African World Cup. I mean, I feel for Ghana, you know, they haven't had the best tournament, one of the best stories, and that's a pretty precious thing to take away. Germany, well, what can I tell you? I find myself as an Englishman saying a surprising thing, but I like this German team. Mm-hmm. I mean, I almost felt watching Germany-England like, oh, thank you very much, someone is at last playing football in front of me. and it was pretty painful, I can tell you. But I like them. I like they're kind of open and honest and attacking, and there's movement and action. And like you say, no big stars. They look like a team, and football's a team game, and we're, you know, we're always going on about the stars and we love them, but in essence it's a team game, and it's great to see them play that way.
You know, I'm very hard-pressed to root for them because I traditionally am an Azzurri fan.
Okay.
I grew up partly in Italy, and you know, if you're either a Brazilian, Italian, or German fan, you know, there's this lifelong competition with 5 cups, 4 cups, and 3 cups.
Sure.
So you don't want to see Germany get their fourth, but I am particularly happy to see this team prosper given two things. One is the ownership structure in the Bundesliga, which, of course, Liverpool fans and Manchester United fans only dream of now. And then the fact that, you know, this is a bit of a more player-friendly league again, where Alex Ferguson, even in relationship to Wayne Rooney's bad performance for England, has said, well, you know, they get a winter break over there. And it's reflective of the maintenance of a progressive social democracy in Germany that is not the case in post-Thatcher Britain and elsewhere around the world.
Absolutely. I think, you know, in Germany, let me put it this way. I think that, you know, to do well in a World Cup, more than anything else, you've got to show up as a team. You know, because that's the trick, because, you know, all these guys playing, you know, for their clubs and immersed in another world, and we know it's only a tiny amount of time to get it together to play what is, in essence, a team game. So if you can do that, I mean, my God, Greece proved in 2004, if you can do that and you've got a plan, you can go anywhere. You know, doesn't matter about the kind of individual talent. And, I think the Germans are very, very good at doing that, and I think they bring with them to the national side something of a wider culture in which the public realm and the common good is still accorded a kind of value, importance and respect that certainly in the England that I live in, I find rarer and rarer.
I suppose just two more questions. The second one, and we'll hold this till the end, is we're speaking now a few minutes away from the kickoff of the first semifinal between Uruguay and Holland, and I'll, of course, want to ask you about the final four teams. But before that, I want to go back into the second question. In your book, again, in the final chapter, as I mentioned, you final section, you call it, The Only Game, Football and the End of History. The end of history is, of course, a reference to Fukuyama's notion that with the end of the Cold War, history was over. Tina, there is no alternative. Capitalism had won. Liberal democratic capitalism had won. 2007 and 2008, that question was sort of reframed again and reasked because all of a sudden the economic model was in severe global crisis. You're a historian and have really written, in my opinion, the definitive history of soccer that's been written to date. It's an exceptional work. It is, as you say at the beginning, there's no cultural practice more global than soccer. The economy and the political system of the world is more globalized than ever. It's 2010, the summer of 2010. We're still in the throes of this incredible financial crisis at the core of the global economy, and the world is mesmerized by a soccer tournament to a greater degree than I think it has ever been. I think this is the most popular World Cup ever, and as such, probably the most popular single cultural event in human history ever. I know it's early, you're a historian, to reflect on this, but any thoughts about what maybe that all means right now in terms of the, not so much the history of soccer, but the social, historical, cultural, political moment that we all live in as citizens of the globe?
Well, I think a lot of the time we have, you know, generally we have a lot of difficulty really imagining ourselves as citizens of the globe. I mean, it seems, you know, we live in an era in which politically, in terms of security arrangements and military power, as well as economics, you know, we live within global structures. But our capacity to, you know, imagine ourselves, you know, the imagined community of the people of this planet is much harder to do. There is, You know, it's a harder task anyway. And then to even begin to think about mobilizing, you know, progressive political forces and transformations on the basis of it is an even tougher thing further on. And therefore, I think, you know, in a very political but with a very small p, the World Cup is, you know, gives me a little heart that there are these moments where we, you know, find a way of looking at ourselves, basically looking at ourselves and having a moment where, you know, we step outside of actually our national identities or our limited and local perspectives and engage at a global level, in a properly popular level. Because, you know, I mean, there's, you know, there's elites all over the world who are kind of thinking about these things. That's pen a penny. But to sort of mobilize half the planet, if only at a kind of, you know, cognitive level rather than a sort of analytical level, I think is a really special and amazing thing. So it's a small thing, but it's a moment. I mean, in terms of the sort of wider financial crisis and the state of global capitalism, and I think, you know, football, like every other institution on the planet, has got some choices to make. Do you want to keep running the game, certainly at the professional level, along lines and models of, you know, the neoliberal consensus, which is certainly what we've done in England over the last 20 years, or are we going to think about alternative systems of regulation and alternative systems of ownership? We know certainly in football there is an alternative, and I'm not sure, you know, well, we'll see how the narratives play out, but you know, at the moment, it may be that a German victory just might nudge a few people to think a bit more in that direction.
Ah, that's a fine point indeed. Almost will make me feel okay if now perhaps the tournament favorite does collect that fourth star on their jersey, tying my former loves, the Azzurri, who were so wretched this time I couldn't get even barely behind them. So the final four teams, David Goldblatt, I'm speaking with the author of The Ball is Round, A Global History of Soccer. We do have this marvelous semifinal tomorrow, Spain versus Germany. This will not have taken place when this interview airs. Do you think that the Spanish, who defeated Germany only in 2008 in the Euro final, rather authoritatively, do you think that that team, which is much the same as it was in 2008, has enough to withstand this new German dynamism?
Oh, I think it does. I think they have to drop Torres. I mean, if they don't drop Torres, then they're playing 10 against 11, and I don't recommend that against this Germany. He's clearly not fit. He's not going to ease himself back into match fitness in a World Cup semi-final. It's time to bite the bullet and drop the boy and put somebody else on. And, you know, when Fabregas was on, I thought Spain looks a different team. If they do that and they raise their game to where it can be, and maybe Germany will do enough attacking to give them the space to get their own passing game going, then they can. But I think this is completely even. This is not the Germany they faced in 2008, and I expect it to be much, much tougher for them. So they can do it, but not with the team that's been playing now. There has to be change.
Holland and Uruguay will have taken place by the time this interview airs. I'll walk out on that gangplank and say that as much as Uruguay have been canny, they have structured their game very well for every opponent. With the people who are absent today, I will be very shocked if they can really stay in this game and give Holland a run for it.
Yeah, no, I mean, they've lost two of their key players, Suarez and what's the other guy called?
Well, Lugano may play.
Lugano
and,
as well.
And Fusile is out, right, yeah.
So
I expect Lugano to take the field at some point just because he's such a gamer. But we'll see in a few minutes.
We'll see. But then, you know, he may not be much help if he's not properly fit. I mean, with Uruguay, you know, on the one hand, I'm cross about Ghana, but I'm not that cross. I mean, it's hard. As a historian of football and as a lover of the little guy,
right. It's
really hard not to love Uruguay. And having spent an absolutely fantastic, tranquil, beautiful week in Montevideo exploring all of this, I have got such a soft spot for Uruguay. It's not true. So I'm going into this game on pure and utterly irrational emotion and nostalgia. And I'm going to be rooting for Uruguay, but I'll be planning for Holland.
Well, David Goldblatt, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. David Goldblatt is the author of the epic History of Soccer, The Ball is Around, A Global History of Soccer. Pick it up. It is just infinitely delightful to read and informative. And then you can also read his blog postings for Prospect Magazine at prospectmagazine.co.uk. David Goldblatt, thank you so much for joining us here on The People's Game.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined now by my co-host Jennifer Doyle, she of the blog From a Left Wing. First off, Jennifer Doyle, what did you think, Holland-Uruguay?
I have to say my whole relationship to the match was soured by a story I read, actually an interview that I read on The Nation's website. Just before the match came on air, Dave Zirin had interviewed some academics who produced a study on the coverage allotted to women athletes relative to coverage allotted to male athletes
mm-hmm.
in sports media. And in 1989, the percentage of media space given to women was a whopping, like, I think it's just under 6%. In recent years, the news is that really sexist representations of female athletes have declined, but that has sadly meant that now coverage of female athletes actually has gone down to 1.6%.
Wow.
Of all, so that's 98.4% of sports media is devoted to the activities of guys. And so I found myself watching the World Cup and just unable to shake that statistic. And it partly poisoned my relationship to watching the match. Because not only was I already predisposed to dislike Uruguay because of Suarez's actions in the goal, right, but Uruguay's women's team is actually the lowest-ranked women's team of all of the national football associations who have squads in the World Cup finals in South Africa. So their women's squad is actually pretty much unranked, which means they're below 120 in the world. And that puts them below pretty much almost every active country. It suggests that their women's program is inactive. And, you know, I just couldn't stop thinking about it. And so, yes, it was actually a more interesting game than I think a lot of people thought it was going to be. People thought that Holland was just going to roll over Uruguay, and I wouldn't say that's what happened at all. Although they did dominate the match. I kind of had one of those moments that I think every critical sports spectator has, where you know I was feeling really kind of alienated by the whole thing. So. I'm still, of course, you know, a passionate fan of the World Cup and following things, but I guess I feel like it's my role to voice these things and to insist upon their importance. I mean, it's shameful that a men's side should be, you know, so obviously talented, you know, come from a country with such a wonderful tradition around football, and that their national women's program should be such a shambles. That should be an embarrassment.
Well,
it shouldn't go unremarked.
Well, let's go over the statistics again. Let's review what you described at the top of your response.
Yeah.
When was it that the coverage was approaching 10%?
Not 10%. I think it was more like 6%, and that was around 1989.
And
in measuring that, the academics behind this study is a man at USC and
right.
a professor, Cookie, who is, I believe she's at Purdue, they actually included in that all representations of female athletes, which includes, like, you know, athletes in bikinis, insulting portrayed female athletes, just, you know, really, really regressive stuff. And they said that good news is that in the recent years, that kind of thing is on the decline. But it's almost as if, you know, when robbed of sexist representations of female athletes, the sports media actually then just chooses not to represent women at all.
Right. Now, Messner wrote a fantastic sociological study of the sexism and homophobia that is so deep-rooted in the way that young men are sort of brought into athletics in high school, I believe is the focus of the work. I think it's called Men
yeah.
at Play.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And I'm familiar with that. And, you know, I think I can see that trend to some extent if you look at things in broad stroke, because I think the way that with the ESPN era coming into play, if you go back to when it was dominated more by a few network outlets, the Olympics maybe played a larger role, therefore figure skating, women's gymnastics in the post-Olga Corbett era, And then women's tennis, I think, probably did get more coverage around that time because tennis in general got more coverage in the American media. Was the study just the American media? I imagine that it was.
I'm virtually certain it was focused on the U.S. media. But you have to remember, for example, think about the voluminous coverage of LeBron James and what is LeBron James going to do.
Right.
That counts in this study. Is all of the punditry, the statistical analysis, the obsessions over absolutely nothing. I mean, that's the kind of thing that actually throws things way off scale. You know, it's like as I was reading that article, I was trying to think of the last time I saw a decent story on television about WPS, for example, the Women's Professional Soccer League, I haven't really seen the true story, the in-depth coverage about what's happened with the two teams that folded in the WPS. I mean, that kind of coverage, which isn't positive coverage, still counts, right? You don't even have the kind of very basic critical engagement and sort of watching that the media performs in relationship to leagues. You know, the NBA with baseball, with the NFL, the media is always riding the leagues and teams, you know, making sure that they're doing the right thing by fans. And fans of women's sports actually don't get the benefit of that kind of coverage. Most people don't know who the biggest stories are in terms of who are the most interesting athletes in women's sports. What are the scandals going on with women's teams? You know, the big issues. You have a big story, like, for example, the Huskies, the Connecticut women's NCAA basketball team, dominating their season, and that gets turned into an embarrassment, actually, in sports coverage. That's the only way in which their dominance was really framed by mainstream sports media was as a problem. And that's a real shame because they have a great tradition and they're a really, really wonderful side. So, you know, I guess I just wish that we would see more critical engagement from other journalists about this subject and a more active resistance to this kind of overwhelming weighting of airtime and to guys. You know, I mean, it's 98.4% of media space, right, gets taken up by men's sports, and I just can't get over that number. It's mind-boggling. It's absolutely mind-boggling.
And you're planning on writing something on this?
Well, this actually for me got started. I mean, this has always been a preoccupation of mine, the imbalance. But more recently, this got triggered by a Nike viral video, which is a quickly produced bit in which the young boys are pictured thanking the U.S. men's national team. And I wrote a few comments on some websites complaining about the ad and saying that it was a real shame that they cut young female players out of the opportunity of participating in sending a thank you to the team like this. Because, of course, the women players, you know, when their kids are as inspired by male players as they are by women players, if not more, because of this very problem, right? If 98.4% of media space is taken up by representations of women, of male athletes, young women have no one else to look up to, right? And so I thought how unfair of Nike to actually then go ahead and erase not only the female athlete in that ad, but the female fan. And making matters even worse, that ad is actually loosely patterned after a Gatorade thing, which made the same gesture to Mia Hamm when she retired. They showed a series of people saying, thank you, Mia, for paving the way to me imagining myself as an athlete. And that was not gender exclusive. It was not just young girls. It was her teammates. It was her family members. It was Michael Jordan saying thank you to Mia Hamm for leading the way and for inspiring him. Now, why is it that when we thank a female athlete, we have a kind of integrated vision of who can support and thank and be a part of the community, right, of fans, right, behind female athleticism? But when we're talking about male athleticism, we can't accommodate female athletes or fans. I just find that absolutely ridiculous and totally offensive. And so, yes, I did write about that.
Well, Jennifer, we'll have you live tomorrow on KPFK in the 8:30 to 9 o'clock slot for the People's Game, and hopefully we'll be able to take some listener calls on the subject as well and hear about where you'll be posting an article on the subject. So thank you for joining us, as always, on the People's Game.
Thank you, Alan.
That's our show for today. I want to thank producer Fernando Ramiro, who also was a guest on today's show, Lazar Trishan, his great blog is nomoreonionbags.com, David Goldblatt, The book is The Ball is Round, A Global History of Soccer. You can also read his blogs about the 2010 World Cup at the Prospect Magazine website. And finally, Jennifer Doyle, whose website is From a Left Wing. And we'll be back again live on KPFK Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. You can hear all of our old shows archived on kpfk.org and also www.thepeoplesgame.org. I'm Alan Minsky, and this has been The People's Game.